Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish-made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Now, Taoiseach and Minister for Foreign Affairs Simon Harris has said he's seeking legal clarity about the use of Shannon Airport as a stopping-off point for the United States aircraft carrying deportees to East Africa. Flight tracking data obtained by the New York Times traced a Gulfstream jet owned by a private company that stopped off at Shannon for 2 hours after leaving an airport in Texas on Tuesday. From Shannon, the airport then travelled on to an airport in Djibouti, where the group is currently being held. The US District Court Judge Brian Murphy in Boston ruled that the Trump administration had violated one of his previous orders, calling the time frame given to the men to contest their expulsion to South Sudan plainly insufficient. In response, Caroline Leavitt, the White House press secretary, had this to say.
The absurdity of this ruling from a district court judge in Boston who is just creating new immigration laws out of thin air. This administration, let me be very clear, because there have been a lot of fake headlines about this deportation flight over the last 2 days. This administration has complied with all court orders. And the individuals whose names I just revealed and whose criminal histories I just spoke of that are on this flight, every single one of them had a final order of removal from our country. In fact, one of them, one of these violent illegal criminals, had a final order of removal given to him in 1999. It's 2 years after I was born. This individual, this criminal, has been living in our country for an entire generation. And now we have a district court judge who is trying to tell the president and the secretary of state and the secretary of homeland security that an illegal criminal murderer who's been hiding in the shadows in our country for nearly 30 years cannot be deported from United States soil. That not only is undermining our entire immigration system, but it is also undermining our diplomatic negotiations with countries around the world. How are countries on this earth supposed to trust the United States government and these good faith diplomatic negotiations, when these countries accept these repatriation flights? How are they supposed to trust us if we have radical district court judges who are going to say, no, you can't do that? And now these illegal criminal murderers and rapists have to sit in Djibouti with our ICE agents who now have to sit there for more than 2 weeks without the proper resources. This judge is not only undermining our immigration system, undermining our foreign policy and our national security, but this judge is undermining the safety of the ICE agents who are putting their lives on the list, on the line to remove this list of illegal criminal terrorists. It's truly despicable what's happening in our court system, and the president and this administration hope that the Supreme Court will do what it needs to do to rein in these liberal activist judges. And the Supreme Court has already said it is well within the president's purview to dictate foreign policy, and a radical district court judge should not be getting in the way of that.
Now, in a moment, we're going to hear whether or not Irish law permits deportation flights to land on our soil. But first, from Washington, D.C., I'm joined on the line now by freelance journalist Sarah Firth. Sarah, good morning to you.
Good morning.
This flight and this ruling, what's the understanding around the due process over these deportations? Because it's not a question of the character of the men on board or their criminal records or not. It's about whether fair procedures were followed in deporting them.
Absolutely right. And at that press conference, you know, you had the White House press secretary mimicking the words of the president, who's also now lashed out at the judge. And this isn't the first time the judges have been in the firing line. But interestingly, she didn't, as well as showing their mugshot, she didn't really address the actual ruling that the judge had issued that had found that the administration had violated a court order to deport these people. Now, most of them were not citizens of South Sudan. That's the first thing. And what the judge has actually said in this case, it wasn't rebuking them for the supposed criminal activities. What he said was that they had been denied time to legally challenge this ruling. So that they hadn't had time to challenge on whether they had a reasonable fear of harm. Of course, there is an ongoing conflict in South Sudan. And so the speed at which this happened meant there was a failure to provide sufficient legal due process to those who've been on the receiving end of these mass deportation orders. And Colm, this isn't the first time that we've seen the administration lashing out at judges in this manner. Also not the first time that the courts have found that the administration is in violation of providing a due process to people who are being caught up in this big, very fast push to get people deported out the country.
And as you say, there is an obligation for people not to be deported to a place where they may have come to harm. South Sudan, there's a State Department advisory warning that there is conflict there and people being advised not to travel there. But the Trump administration is clear in its view around deportations. It seems to be doubling down on this. We heard an interview with the Vice President J.D. Vance with the New York Times insisting that they would continue down these paths. So can we expect to see more of these types of flights?
I think it is likely, given the fact that this is something now that we're seeing repeatedly happen. There is this ongoing division between the administration and some of the courts. Now, in this case, it was U.S. District Judge Brian E. Murphy in Boston. He was an appointee of President Joe Biden. But what we've seen is these, you know, attacks like the type from the White House press secretary calling them liberal activist judges for their rulings. There have been some very heavy criticisms from those in the legal profession and from very high level judges themselves saying that this is just simply not the way that the country operates, having the administration interfere in court rulings in this way. And as I said, you know, President Trump himself, he name checked this judge and this case on social media and accusing him of knowing absolutely nothing about the situation and then saying the judges are absolutely out of control. They're hurting our country. It must change immediately and warning that thousands of hardened criminals could break down the walls. I do just want to note one of the things that's been raised repeatedly is, again, a lot of the problems with what's happening and these clashes between the administration lashing out at judges in this way is happening not because of any disputes about the people themselves and the alleged criminal convictions. It is about, as you pointed out, the legal due process. So ensuring that people have time to launch legal challenges. And this is where the problems are really arising with the speed of these mass deportations. And as we've seen in this case, you've actually got the administration essentially trying to comply. They're going to remain in Djibouti now, as you heard Caroline Levitt mention there, for 2 weeks to try and comply with this order. But it's sort of shutting the door after the horses bolted or after the planes taken off and landed, Colin.
And the means of the administration complying legally with this is to invoke wartime powers and to characterise people coming to the country illegally as a form of invasion.
Yes, and the vice president in particular in recent days has been challenged over this because he was asked very bluntly, you know, of course, look, with the numbers of people that we're seeing with these mass deportations, you can't be claiming that all of them fall under this very old wartime provision. We're not at war with all these different countries. But yes, and there are very big questions about the legality of the way that law is being interpreted itself. But the vice president, the president himself are very clear and they've set themselves up this mission. Remember, President Trump ran on this platform of promising to deport millions, he said, of illegal migrants. And the numbers are simply not adding up, Colm. I mean, the promises he made and the numbers that the president has talked about in the past, it would be, you know, when we've sort of crunched the numbers, it's sort of impossible figures of deportations that would have to happen to meet any of those promises. But what we have seen is that clearly the administration making a huge effort to get large numbers of people out the country. And so in that push, in that rush to meet some of the demands that they set themselves, some of those bars that they set themselves for these deportations, they are running afoul of the justice system here in the US.
Okay, Sarah Firth, freelance journalist in Washington, D.C. Thanks very much for joining us this morning. We're also joined on the line by Cathal Malone. He's head of legal research at Thomas Coughlin and Co. Solicitors. Cathal, good morning to you. I suppose the first question is, given that this flight landed in Shannon as aviation air spotters saw on its way to Djibouti, does Irish law permit extrajudicial flights like this to land on our soil?
Well, Irish law would generally permit an aircraft to land for what are called non-traffic reasons. In other words, people aren't getting on or off to refuel. that would be the responsibility of the Minister for Transport. What's different about this is the fact that there were people on board who were being detained against their will. And under Irish law, as indeed under English law or American law, there is the right of habeas corpus, which is the right of any person who is unlawfully detained, that they have the right to petition a court to inquire into the legality of their detention. Now, whether you look at it as a matter of American law or Irish law, these people were being unlawfully detained. We know they were unlawfully detained under American law because we have an order of a district court judge that said so, and indeed Judge Murphy has already found that, the order not to have them removed was violated, and that's why they're now in Djibouti rather than South Sudan. As a matter of Irish law, however, they would have the right to claim asylum here. And what's interesting about this case, as your last guest said, is in fact of the eight men on that flight, seven of them are not citizens of South Sudan. And the only reason that they're being sent to South Sudan is that they cannot safely be removed to their home countries. And so these are people who cannot be deported home to where they come from. And so the administration has decided to essentially dump them in South Sudan, which is the world's newest country and a war zone. And what I found very interesting in the clip you had from the White House Press Secretary, Catherine Levitt, is that she said something very telling, and I think she didn't quite mean to let it blurt out, but she said that the ICE agents were putting their lives in harm's way, having to sit in Djibouti for over 2 weeks guarding these men. Now, if it's not safe for the ICE agents to be sitting near a war zone, it can hardly be safe to dump these men there for the rest of their lives either.
Although I think the implication was that potentially that they weren't safe because they were sitting in the company of these particular men. We did hear earlier on the programme, on Morning Ireland, the programme before we came on air, Gillian Brockle, who is an aircraft spotter, who was the first to find the aircraft had landed in Shannon, and she got onto the phone to the guards and was, she says, on the phone for 13 minutes giving them details of this flight. I mean, would that have made a difference?
The difficulty here is that, as a matter of long-standing practice, we have this idea of trust but don't verify when it comes to the United States. I mean, if we look back, I mean, your viewers may remember, during the Bush administration, there were the extraordinary rendition flights where people were being taken from places like Iraq and Afghanistan to CIA black sites around the world, and this has all now been well-documented, including through the Snowden leaks. Many of those flights passed through Shannon with detainees on board. We find this out decades later, and only through leaked intelligence. At the time, people had concerns in this regard, but the long-standing position of the Department of Foreign Affairs has been the Americans have made us promises and we're sure that they'll keep them. Now, unfortunately, even if America has traditionally been regarded as a very good ally, given that there is credible evidence that there have been weapons passing through and also that there have been people who have been on these flights who don't want to be on them, to put it mildly, I think we're beyond the point where we should be accepting assurances without checking. But as I say, I mean, more directly, whatever about An Garda Síochána, I mean, if this were to happen again, and if the Irish legal community were aware that this was on the way, I would be very surprised if an application weren't made to the Irish High Court for a habeas corpus petition in respect of one or more of these people, because if they
How would somebody go about that?
It is a very, very simple procedure. Any person in Ireland can make a complaint at any time to any High Court judge and allege that within the jurisdiction, any person, whether they know them or not, is being unlawfully detained. And that judge can then order that the body of the person be produced before the court. That's habeas corpus is literally Latin for let me have the body. And they can order the person be brought before them to inquire as to whether or not they're being lawfully held. And if they're not being lawfully held, they can be released. And it's an ancient prerogative right. It goes back to the English common law 1,000 years ago. It's enshrined in the US Constitution and the Irish Constitution. And it is in fact the only court procedure that is provided for in the Irish Constitution. It can't be repealed by law. And that is because it has been considered since ancient times probably the most essential thing for the preservation of liberty, is the idea that no person can hold another without their will, without the ability of a judge to figure out whether it's legal or not.
All right. And at any time of the day or night, and do you need a solicitor? I mean, how else would one file the necessary papers to a High Court judge?
At any time of the day or night, is indeed true. You technically don't even need paperwork. Now, if you were to go before the court and just say that you thought there was something happening, they would probably ask you to go off and swear an affidavit saying how you know what you know. But okay. It's a very informal procedure because it's designed to be speedy for exactly these reasons.
And could it be done by somebody from outside the jurisdiction? Say, if the aircraft spotter had seen that and had known about the procedure, would they be entitled under law, like Gillian Brockle, instead of ringing the guards, had attempted to file a habeas corpus writ? Could that have been done?
It would require somebody to be in Ireland to make the complaint, and okay. It would also require that the person be within Irish jurisdiction. But once it was within Irish airspace, the complaint could be made.
And, I mean, is anyone, I mean, I think there is currently ongoing, or a report was requested under the by Eamon Ryan when he was the relevant minister, but is there any ongoing monitoring or any means legally of spot-checking flights?
There is absolutely no monitoring done, nor has there ever been. And my understanding is that the agreement between Ireland and America is essentially that they promise that they will and won't do certain things, and we then take that on faith. I mean, of course, we would have the right, if we believed there was a breach of the law happening, to search a plane, but I don't believe it's ever happened in history, and I can't see that changing anytime soon.
And, you know, customs, like any airfield around the country, could be visited by customs on suspicion, but, you know, to do a spot check. Can customs legally check planes? And if so, what's the difference between checking planes for contraband and checking planes by means of a spot check for arms or people held against their will?
Well, in general, you would require some reasonable suspicion, I think, in respect of these planes, because they're essentially sovereign planes of another state. Even if they're private planes, they're contracted in the same way that Jim O'Callaghan's contracting a plane for deportation flights from Ireland. However, if you had a reasonable suspicion that a serious offence was being committed, An Garda Síochána could, of course, get a warrant. And, I mean, in the circumstances that were at play here, you'd imagine that you'd have more than reasonable suspicion. And, of course, we've now had it retrospectively confirmed that it was indeed the plane in question.
Okay. All right, well, we'll be thrashing some of that out with our people on the gathering there. That's Cathal Malone, Head of Legal Research at Thomas Coughlin and Co Solicitors, and thanks very much for joining us this morning on that. Now, staying with controversial issues in the United States, the Trump administration has revoked Harvard University's ability to enroll international students, saying thousands of current students have to transfer to other schools or leave the country. The U.S. Homeland Security Secretary, Kristi Noem, accused Harvard of fostering violence, anti-Semitism, and coordinating with the Chinese Communist Party on campus. Harvard called the action unlawful and said it's working to provide guidance to students. Now, the college itself enrolls almost 6,800 foreign students on its campus in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and that accounts for more than a quarter of the student body, and most are graduate students coming from more than 100 countries. But one of the students on the campus, an undergraduate rather than a graduate student, is Cormac Savage. He's from County Down and he's studying government and Romance languages and literature at Harvard. Good morning, Cormac.
Good morning, how are you?
Good, thanks. And can you tell us what's your situation at the moment as you know it?
Yeah, so I've just finished my fourth year as an undergraduate at Harvard. So I came here in 2021 as a first-year student, and I'm about to get my undergraduate degree just as all this news has come this week about Harvard having its right to host international students like me revoked.
So anyone coming up to finishing their degree, it's a kind of a time of trepidation. You're wrapping up last minute work, but there's a sense of excitement, no doubt, as well. When did you hear the news and how did you hear it?
Of course, this is the most exciting part of any undergraduate at Harvard's time. You get right to this point and you're the only people left on campus. So it's just the seniors left. And I heard, to be honest, just really today as I had come out of the bathroom and I turned on my phone and I had a notification from the New York Times just that this right that Harvard has to host foreign students was gone out of nowhere.
And did you kind of do a double take on it and say, you know, does this apply to me? What was the first call you made after that?
So we had been aware about 6 weeks ago that this was a threat that was going on in the current battle between Harvard and the Trump administration. But in all honesty, it was something that we thought had been settled and that wasn't going to happen, at least not in my time, in the time that I would be there. So it was very, 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 very shocking, at least when we first heard it.
Right, so you're studying government and Romance languages, and there's already a lot of international students in Harvard, nearly 7,000 of them. So you probably have quite a diverse and varied friend and colleague group in the college. So what's the feeling amongst other international students?
I think that there's a really sort of scared feeling among a lot of internationals. I'm one of the lucky ones. I'm moving back to Europe after I graduate, but I have friends who are planning to stay in the United States for the next year or so, and their ability to stay in the United States after this announcement is contingent on the administration allowing Harvard to have them stay. So it's been really tough on a lot of people, and that's I think maybe the untold story is that even after you graduate, anyone who wants to stay for what's called their extra grace year in the United States is contingent on them being a graduate of Harvard and the American government seeing Harvard as a valid place that they've graduated from it, they'll allow them to sponsor a visa for.
And what are your fellow American students saying to you? Is there any sense of awkwardness about this? They probably feel quite bad for any foreign students.
They really do, and I have a lot of American friends, and a lot of them really are just in a place of looking at sort of their foreign students. You know, once you're here, you really are just all one student body, and they're sort of saying, we're so sorry, and a lot of them wish they could do more. I know some of them in recent weeks have been at protests and have been saying, we wish we could do more for you, but it's at the end of the day, this is a fight between Harvard and the federal government that we're caught in the crossfire of, and yeah.
I think initially, just by way of background, there had been a threat to cut funding to Harvard, and Harvard said they would fill that hole if necessary through their own resources. But this issue of preventing Harvard from accepting or keeping on its 6,800 foreign students is an escalation.
Yeah, it massively is. I mean, when this sort of argument between Harvard and the federal government began, that was the threat. And it was the federal government saying, we're going to take away your funding. We're going to go after everywhere in which we know that we can get you, kind of. And for what it's worth, that is a hugely important bed of funding that Harvard receives from the federal government. Harvard does incredible work in trying to cure rare types of cancer and also trying to like go after really, really rare diseases alongside the federal government. And they have done incredibly important research in the last 4 years that I've been here in all of those areas. This was kind of the federal government's last chance saloon. This was the last thing that they had, and the case was you might be able to go to the private sector and make up the funding that we give you in terms of the work that you do and the research that you do, but this is one thing that you can't make up without us. And so this was the one thing we never really saw coming.
Harvard says it's fully committed to maintaining the ability to host international students and scholars who hail from 140 countries. That's a quote from their statement. But have you got any correspondence personally from Harvard by way of reassurance or to outline some of the efforts or even legal avenues they'll pursue? Because I think they're on record as saying they believe this is unlawful.
Yeah, the college are definitely on record as saying that they believe this is unlawful. What has been really nice is knowing that they have the resources and they have the backing from their alumni to go with the federal government and to say that this is unlawful, and for them to say that they have the resources and the wherewithal to know that it is. But to be honest, we haven't received anything from them right now to say one way or another. And I'd imagine that's because they're preparing a legal case, and we'll probably read about that in the newspapers tomorrow. But they are truly, and have been since the beginning of their dispute with the federal government, behind their students at every juncture. And that's what I'm really proud as a student to say that they have done.
Now, you went to Harvard to study, as I said at the outset, government and Romance languages. I mean, you're obviously a bit of a politics junkie, a nerd even. I say that as somebody who presents political programs.
You could say that,
so that's entirely a compliment, Cormac. But to find yourself in the middle of a big political story where new ground is being broken, I'm sure you'd rather not be connected to it in this way. But is part of your brain fascinated by this whole process to be in the middle of a major political rupture in the United States?
Completely. I mean, the United States is one of the most fascinating countries in the world because of what it is for being a country that was founded as a republic and founded on the basis of freedom. And I think that it's fascinating now to, in my fourth year living in a country that is founded on freedom, see myself being completely in what, in my opinion, is at the center of a great assault on freedom. Which is that the United States is known for having some of the greatest universities in the world, having the greatest sense of academic and freedom of speech in the world. So for me now to be in the middle of it, being at the center of how the very foundation of this country is being shaken is really, really fascinating. You know, it's certainly not enjoyable, but is an incredible place to be in for sure.
And do you have any idea what's going to happen to you, even the basics of, you know, staying in your room, staying in the States, status of visa, any of that kind of stuff? Or are you still trying to pull all of that together and get a sense of where you're at the moment?
As I talk to you right now, the very news that has broken about Harvard and losing their right to host students is 12 hours old. So I really still have no idea. My hope would be that I'll still be able to walk across the stage and pick up a degree on Thursday. And beyond that, I really have nothing to hope or want for.
Right. But it's hope at this stage rather than you're sure. Okay.
Yeah.
Just as a matter of curiosity, how did you end up in Harvard?
I'm originally from the north. I'm from County Down. And I had always, from I was about 9 or 10 years old, wanted to go to college in the United States, and I decided literally in my last year of school that Harvard was the place I'd really like to go. And it really was a bit of hope. I threw in an application and hope for the best. And then once I got in, I moved over here after being 18. It was really just a lot of luck.
And has it been good?
It's been incredible. Truly the best 4 years of my life. Yeah. I mean, I've met.
It's lived up to everything you expected, is it? That 8 or 9 year old who was thinking about going to college in the States, which of course is like beamed at you in so many movies. It's lived up to all of that, has it?
Lived up to and even more so. It's a complete miracle of a place. I have some of those wonderful friends. I've had the most incredible experience. It's been like living inside a movie for the past 4 years.
Right. Why are you coming back? Well, I mean, you may have to, but you'd plan to come back anyway. Further study on the cards, is it?
No, I'm going to move to Brussels and work in the EU for a little while and then hopefully eventually end up back in Ireland.
Okay, well, brilliant. Look, best of luck with your next steps. I do hope you get to take to the stage and grab that parchment next Thursday, and I hope you're not heading to the airport too soon afterwards with all that's going on.
Thank you very much. Me too.
All the best. Get a good sleep, Cormac. Thanks for chatting to us.
Thank you.
You're so good for staying up. Thanks a million. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.